This is Common Ground, a program on world affairs and the people who shape events.
For decades, the general consensus between both the United States and Mexico was that simply we had to tolerate undocumented and illegal immigration because a border could not be managed, the border could not be controlled. What we did in El Paso was completely turn that around, and we basically caught a lot of people by surprise.
In this edition of Common Ground, a change in tactics at points on the U.S.-Mexican border has slowed the flow of illegal immigrants and forced the United States and Mexico to look at political ramifications of illegal immigration in a new light. And then later, a Russian parliamentarian warns of a possible downturn in U.S.-Russian relations.
And we may find ourselves in great controversies and quarrels, maybe even conflicts, over the rest of this decade if we do not take some extraordinary measures to achieve a breakthrough to stabilize our relations.
Common Ground is produced by the Stanley Foundation. I'm Jeff Martin. In 1993, Sylvester Reyes became chief agent of the U.S. Border Patrol in El Paso. Shortly thereafter, he implemented a radically new approach to border control, dramatically reducing the number of illegal entrants into the United States. The new policy, called Hold the Line, has had a profound effect on the communities of El Paso and Juarez, and has been copied at other points along the border. It also cast a new light on a major issue in U.S.-Mexican relations. We talked with Reyes about the new border operation and why he so dramatically changed tactics.
Well, when I first arrived there in the summer of 93, what I found was a border that was very much out of control, a situation where our agents were pulled back within the confines of the metropolitan area of El Paso, and we had really uncontrolled illegal entries where the undocumented people coming into that particular area felt very comfortable in crossing the Rio Grande River and actually staging and massing on the U.S. side of the border. What we tried to do in terms of the initial operation, which we named Operation Blockade, was to change the strategy and place initially about 400 agents right on the international line, not so much concentrating on apprehending individuals, but being in a high-profile status to discourage them from even attempting to enter into the metropolitan area of El Paso.
And before, you had apprehended them after they were in the town, is that right?
Well, before, agents were chasing people down in the neighborhoods adjoining the border. They were stopping people at random that they believed to be undocumented, and it created a tremendous ill will in the community itself. Besides, one of which was, it was a strategy that was very ineffective. Between 8 and 10,000 illegal entries occurred prior to Operation Hold the Line, where today we probably are seeing less than 200, 250 in that neighborhood.
What has been the impact on the community? Obviously, people are moving back and forth across the border a lot, and probably some employers on the U.S. side were depending on some of those people. Is that still happening?
Well, first of all, I don't presume to tell anyone that the border is sealed. It's never been about sealing the border. It has been about doing a better job, doing a more professional job, and changing the whole complexity of the border from a border that was chaotic and out of control and very negative in terms of how it impacted the cities of El Paso and Juarez to one that is much more peaceful, much more tranquil, where people that are entering and moving back and forth between the cities of Juarez and El Paso are doing so through the designated ports of entry, through the bridges, and doing so without all the negativity surrounding uncontrolled illegal immigration.
Has there been good support in the community of El Paso, and what about on the other side of the border?
Well, initially, once you dramatically change the rules of, of operating, such as we did with the implementation of the operation on September 19th of 93. There was a lot of skepticism. There was a lot of hand-wringing, and there was a lot of complaining about the long-range impact that it would have on international relations. At the time, NAFTA was being considered, and there were even concerns that long-term implications would scuttle NAFTA. I'm happy to tell you that over the course of time, because we re-educated both those communities, the support for what we've done has been nothing short of outstanding. We've seen a number of benefits that that can be traced back to the change in the strategy. For instance, vehicle thefts are down over 30%. Home burglaries are down over 30%. Vehicle burglaries are down over 30%. We don't have the problems that we had prior to the change in strategy, such as the presence of panhandlers and elements that were negatively impacting on the texture of the city of El Paso. One of the byproducts here 18 months later has been that even the community in Juarez recognizes that there is better opportunity for everybody in the region. There's better opportunity for commerce, for tourism, for business enterprise. When you factor in the fact that you have a border that's peaceful and tranquil without all the negative things such as our agents being accused of civil rights violations and all of those things, shootings and muggings and rapes and things along those lines.
I think I read that that initially the operation was not too well received in Washington by the Immigration and Naturalization Service. What was behind that, and has that turned around now?
Well, I think it's important to note that there were a number of things that occurred with the initial success of the change in strategy. First of all, there were a number of us, myself included, that were frankly very much surprised that the community came out with such overwhelming support for what we had done. In other words, the community instantly recognized the potential to be rid of all the negative factors that were impacting the city of El Paso. We proposed this change in strategy, and we did it following our routine, normal course of action. That is, we wrote up the plan, we submitted it for approval. It was approved in Washington by both the INS and the Department of Justice. I think where the controversy existed was in the overwhelming impact that it had, because for decades, the general consensus between both the United States and Mexico was that simply we had to tolerate undocumented and illegal immigration because a border could not be managed, a border could not be controlled. What we did in El Paso was completely turn that around, and we basically caught a lot of people by surprise. And there were a lot of people, frankly, that were initially, because of the political nature of the operation and the impact that it was having on U.S.-Mexican relations, that were frankly waiting to see which way it was going to go. I think that's where you got some of that impression that perhaps people in our headquarters or in Washington were reluctant to buy into it.
Has this been duplicated now or replicated in some ways in other parts along the border?
Well, as a result of what we've been able to accomplish with Operation Hold the Line, in proving that it's much more practical and a saner policy to deter people from entering illegally. As a result of that, we've now seen operations started in San Diego with Operation Gatekeeper, which is having similar results, although I will tell you there has been some criticism because the results have been slower in coming, but I think we're certainly on the right track. And then most recently, the operation was extended to the Arizona border, and I think they're showing the same types of general results as we have, although not as dramatic as the El Paso Juarez region.
It's a long border. Can this be done all the way along? It's like 2,000 miles or something. Can this be done all the way along the border, or are there just key points that need to be patrolled more carefully?
Well, I think you hit the point there where although it's a 2,000-mile border, certainly there are specific corridors that we need to consider doing a change in strategy or doing something similar to the Operation Hold the Line initiative. You don't have to worry about the whole 2,000 miles. You just worry about the areas that undocumented immigrants focus in on. And it will be a combination of things that we will have to do. It won't be exclusively manpower. It can be border fencing, other types of barriers, the use of technology, and then a mixture of all of the above, including personnel resources. Certainly, I think for the first time, people now understand that there are long-term implications that go with border control, international relations, political decisions, foreign policy decisions, things along those lines are all very much part of the mixture and part of the formula. But I think it brings up the issue to a level that governments now have to make a decision. If border control is important, then border control must be approached by on a bilateral basis, where both the United States and Mexico accept responsibility for that international boundary.
Along those lines, I guess, too, I think I read somewhere that in the San Diego-Tijuana area, there's been buildup of people who were wanting to cross the borders, of people who were waiting longer to try to get across the border. With that buildup of population, there's been nefarious types who've been preying on them and that kind of thing. Have you seen any of that kind of thing in the El Paso Juarez area?
Well, I think as we are successful and as people get frustrated in not being able to circumvent operational areas, I think you have a situation where they come back and try to beat the operation and try to beat the strategy by hiring smugglers, by using decoying tactics, by possibly using tactics where they gather and then they run what we call banzai attacks on our positions. All of those things have to be looked at from a perspective that when you have a change in strategy, it's a very fluid type of situation, because as they adjust, we have to adjust. And as we're adjusting, we're hoping that the success that has been shown through this border control effort has to be bought into by the government of Mexico. The government of Mexico has to accept and understand that their jurisdiction on their side of the international border is important to both countries, if things such as NAFTA or commerce or tourism or facilitation of cross-border traffic has to be taken into account. I think it has to be a joint and a partnership type relationship.
One last question. What's the impact been on the men and women who are in the Border Patrol? Has it been a morale boost for them, or do they feel pretty good about this operation?
Well, it's kind of been a mixed bag in terms of the reaction. First of all, it's been a very dramatic change in strategy. Before, under the old system, if you had 200 agents working in a particular area, you essentially had 200 different immigration policies, because they could pick and choose who they were going to stop. Because our strategy now dictates that they remain in fixed post within eyesight of each other, and because under this strategy, it's a much more constrained operational area that they have responsibility for. Clearly, some of the things that are taking its toll on our agents is the fact that it can be boring, it can be tedious, it can be something that is not perhaps as exciting as they were used to. People in my position need to understand that we need to get the resources in place to rotate our agents off of that strategy and give them other types of duties, which we have. But the consequence of that is that we can't do it until we get adequate personnel. And that's a long-term commitment by the agency, and that's where we're at right now.
That was Sylvester Reyes, chief agent of the U.S. Border Patrol in El Paso. In a moment, do U.S.-Russian relations face a perilous future?
We are facing degradation, or maybe even disintegration, of the whole system of the arms control and disarmament treaties and agreements.
You're listening to Common Ground. Printed transcripts and audio cassettes of this program are available from Journal Graphics. Listen at the end of the broadcast for details. Common Ground is a service of the Stanley Foundation, a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that conducts varied programs and activities meant to provoke thought and encourage dialogue on world affairs. When the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991, both Russians and Americans were jubilant for the first time about democracy's prospects in Russia and the corresponding hope for a new era of peace between the two superpowers. But in this next report, Mary Gray Davidson talks to one Russian parliamentarian with a decidedly more gloomy outlook for Russia and U.S.-Russian relations.
Alexei Arbatov makes no bones about the dismal state of affairs in Russia. Overall, the quality of life has sunken so low that many Russians are questioning whether their newfound freedoms are worth the price. These domestic problems are having a dramatic impact on Russian politics, says Arbatov, a member of the Russian parliament. Arbatov belongs to the Yabloka Party, a moderate right-wing faction of the Labor Party. He's chairman of the Subcommittee on International Security and Arms Control in parliament. The discontent within Russia is so widespread, says Arbatov, that even military agreements between the U.S. and Russia that once seemed destined for approval are now very much in question, as are general U.S.-Russian relations.
We are in big trouble, and we may find ourselves in great controversies and quarrels, maybe even conflicts, over the rest of this decade if we do not take some extraordinary measures to achieve a breakthrough to stabilize our relations. First of all, we are on shaky grounds with regards to Russian relations with other former Soviet republics, in particular Ukraine. Ukraine is a key country. It's a huge European country, 50 million of population, rich with resources, still having hundreds of nuclear weapons on its territory. It looks like we are starting to look differently at relations with Ukraine. Now we are getting in a classical triangle: Russia, United States, and Ukraine. And we may find ourselves in a situation of great misunderstanding with regards to Ukraine, in particular if NATO extends eastward. Another issue is that we are facing degradation or maybe even disintegration of the whole system of the arms control and disarmament treaties and agreements. START treaty has very small chances for ratification. ABM treaty may be undercut.
START ratification
START
within the U.S.?
In Russia, first of all, in Russia, but maybe also as a consequence in the United States. I don't think they will ratify it unless mm-hmm. Russia ratifies.
Mm-hmm. And why wouldn't Russia ratify it?
Because this treaty is seen in Russia as massively unfair and unbalanced. It's being seen in Russia as a treaty signed when Russia was very weak and was basically very subservient to the United States policy. And besides, it's economically, it's quite expensive for Russia to destroy, eliminate so many weapons. We do not have resources. All those questions could be resolved in a different atmosphere, but I'm afraid that we are losing touch with the United States. So the ABM treaty may be undercut. Conventional force reductions in Europe, which is called CFE treaty, will probably be not complied with by Russia, so it's facing a threat of disintegration.
Why wouldn't Russia comply with it?
Because the flank quotas, which are established for this treaty, are too narrow for Russia, which is now deep in the war in Chechnya and has deployed a lot of forces in the south, because the south is perceived in Russia as the most unstable area, very close to Russian central region, threatening with instability Russian territory and including the central, the core, the heartland of Russia. So Russia has deployed a lot of troops there.
And just as we saw during the Cold War, the U.S. and Russia are on opposing sides of a number of regional disputes.
For instance, in the Gulf area and Middle East, The United States clearly favored Turkey. Russia favors Iran. This is an objective difference of interest. It's nothing to panic about, but it has to be negotiated with goodwill. It's not to be made a subject of great discord between Russia and the West. We are in disagreement on such important issues as arms trade, nuclear trade, nuclear materials trade and transfers. Russian deal with Iran, for instance. It was taken exactly within the rules of the NPT treaty, but the United States objected it. And there was some reason for objections, because apart from nuclear reactors, Russia was planning, apparently, to deliver a uranium enrichment facility, which is a dual-purpose technology and may be used to get weapons-grade uranium for a nuclear bomb. That should not have been done. That is a great mistake of President Yeltsin in not able to control his bureaucracy, which is striking deals like that. But on the other hand, the United States also took a position which was not very fair. The United States are now planning to deliver the same kind of light water nuclear reactors to North Korea. For many decades, North Korea was the worst evil in the world for the United States. And Russian nuclear cooperation with North Korea was portrayed by the United States, with some good reason, as destabilizing. Now, a year ago, the United States changed its relations with North Korea. Russia was pushed out of North Korean market, and the United States had a deal with North Korea to provide it with nuclear reactors, while the regime didn't change at all. The nature of the regime is just the same, and all of a sudden it ceased to be an evil empire. It's now recipient of U.S. grants and help and technology. And Russians are fearful that, or are suspicious that the same may happen with Iran. Who would guarantee that in half a year, United States would not change its relations with Iran and have a deal with Iran to provide Iran with United States light water nuclear reactors after Russia, under American pressure, withdraws from this area? This is an argument which is very strong in Russia. Some groups, many groups, political groups and agencies are trying to create perception of the U.S. policy on this question as not a policy designed to enhance non-proliferation, but rather a policy which is designed to push Russia from its markets and to take Russian place under the pretext of non-proliferation.
So it's inconsistency that's really bothersome, and maybe not necessarily the complexity of American politics or the thinking that maybe dealing with North Korea by providing it with nuclear reactors would modify the regime or something like that.
Well, we might say the same thing. Dealing with Iran might modify the regime. Mm-hmm. Why should the United States do all the modifying and gain a couple of billion dollars on that and not Russia?
Arbatov concludes by saying that the United States has gotten used to Russia giving in to whatever the U.S. demanded, but that attitude had better change.
During the last 3 years, the United States got used to very easy way of dealing with Russia, because Russian top foreign policymakers were very flexible, infinitely flexible with the United States. They were ready to make concessions to the United States. They were ready to say yes even before they were asked for. And the United States got so, I would say, carried away by this easy way that they lost sight of some more fundamental problems. In particular, that the Russian subservient policy was very easy for the United States, but had one major deficiency. It didn't have any domestic support. It was a policy of a few persons in the top Russian decision-making echelons, and it didn't have any constituency, either in the public or in the parliament or in public organizations or in major social groups. So the United States, instead of demanding from the Russian political leaders to prove that their policy relies on strong domestic support, they rather chose to close their eyes on the great distance between Russian foreign policy and Russian domestic moods. What we have now is that Russian domestic moods are affecting more and more Russian policy. And even infinitely flexible Russian foreign policy makers can no longer make such easy concessions because their personal position will be threatened. There is a growing opposition in Russia as a response to that subservient policy of Russia of the recent years. So the United States should rather make a different choice. It would be better for Russia and the United States to strike deals which would not be so immensely favorable to the United States, but rather more equal. But, on the other hand, that would have a strong enough domestic political support in Russia, then have easy deals which are very favorable for the United States, but which have no domestic support and no chances of implementation. This refers to some of the arms control agreements we've had. I've already addressed that. But also this refers to a lot of other things which are being discussed now. And Russian growing resistance to unequal deals, unfair deals with the United States should not be always perceived in the United States as a revival of Russian nationalism or revival of Russian aggressive intent. Rather, the preceding several years should be understood in the United States as something very unique and unnatural. It could not hold for long. On the other hand, when Russia is not complying with its commitments, with treaties and agreements which already have been concluded, I would advise the United States to bring it to the attention of Russian leaders and to be much more insistent on Russian playing according to the rules of the game.
That's Alexei Arbatov, a member of the Russian Parliament and chairman of the Parliament's Subcommittee on International Security and Arms Control. For Common Ground, I'm Mary Gray Davidson.
For a printed transcript or an audio cassette of this program, please send $5 per transcript or $11.70 per cassette to Common Ground, show number 9529, Journal Graphics, 1535 Grant Street, Denver, Colorado, 80203. Again, ask for program number 9529. To order by credit card, call toll-free 1-800-825-5746. If you'd like more information about the Stanley Foundation or you have some comments about the program, write to us at 216 Sycamore Street, Muscatine, Iowa, 52761. Again, the toll-free number to order cassettes or transcripts is 1-800-825-5746. For Common Ground, I'm Jeff Martin. B.J. Lederman created our theme music. Common Ground was produced and funded by the Stanley Foundation.